It's Monday, February 10, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The 2014 Winter Olympics are now well underway in Sochi, Russia. It is a warm weather resort turned into a cold weather Olympiad, all demonstrating the force of will of Russian President Vladimir Putin. These games thus come 34 years after the former Soviet Union hosted the 1980 Summer Olympics. Those Olympic Games were boycotted by the United States under the leadership of President Jimmy Carter, protesting the Russian invasion of the nation of Afghanistan. If anything, what all this demonstrates is that the Olympic Games are always political. This case was made very revealing in the pages of USA Today by Louise Branson, a former Moscow correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. She writes, quote, "For all that Olympics are intended to be an apolitical event dedicated to athletic competition, they have a way of laying bare political realities, particularly in dictatorial societies." Branson went on to write, "That is how it was in Moscow in 1980. That is how it is in Sochi in 2014. So much the better." End quote. One of the most interesting aspects of the 2014 Winter Games thus far is how much attention is being given to virtually everything but the athletic competitions themselves. There is a great deal of concern about the risk of international terrorism. After all, the Caucasus region, one of the hotbeds of political terrorism worldwide, is just a matter of a half-day's drive from the Olympic Games in Sochi. Furthermore, the bombings undertaken by two female suicide bombers in recent weeks have demonstrated the very real capacity of terrorists to strike. On the other hand, a so-called ring of steel has been put around the Olympic Games in Sochi, a ring of steel that includes 100,000 military personnel, missiles now bristling on the hillsides outside of Sochi, and untold security preparations that have been taken, and even the United States is now complaining that it is being cut out of the loop. The security precautions being so tight that not even the United States military is being let in on the specifics. We must certainly hope and pray that there will be no terrorist attack on the Olympic Games, but we also have to recognize that there is always a political background to an international event such as an Olympiad. The modern Olympics movement is barely over a century old. It was born in a time of unfounded human optimism. This is about the time that the world was declaring that war was to be illegal. The modern resurrection of the Olympic Games was to demonstrate international brotherhood, as it was called then, an international fraternity of athletes. Politics was supposed to recede into the background, even as the 20th century was dawning and the international system was itself about to blow apart with two murderous world wars. But the Olympiad has never been an apolitical event. And from a Christian worldview perspective, we recognize that it can't be. It can't be for at least two reasons. The first is basic human nature. When we understand the Christian doctrine of sin, we come to understand that sin necessarily and pervasively affects and corrupts everything human beings touch, to what we might describe as a greater or a lesser extent. That's where the second insight comes in. The Christian worldview reminds us that there are greater opportunities for corruption where there are greater complexities and the involvement of additional people with additional reasons and motivations for wrongdoing. That's why, for instance, in the American system of government, we have a separation of powers, a system of checks and balances that was based in a Christian worldview assumption that the concentration of power can lead very quickly to a concentration of evil, or that power being put to evil ends. When it comes to the Olympiad, we have an international council that has itself repeatedly been found guilty of its own forms of corruption. Corruption having to do with the site selection for Olympiads, corruption having to do with judging an individual events. And what we're looking at is hardly in the first place what we are being told it is, at least officially. Officially, we're told that this is an international gathering of athletes representing their respective nations in order to demonstrate international brotherhood and fraternity as amateur athletes. Of course, one of the great scandals of the entire Olympics movement has been the definition of what it means to be an amateur, because in various athletic competitions, it's very clear that those who are participating are anything but amateurs. Even where the Olympics Committee has made its own effort to redefine what it means to be an amateur, or on a limited basis to allow non-amateur participants, the reality is that going all the way back to the Cold War, it was very evident that the Soviet Union and its satellites were using the word amateur to basically serve as a cover for full-time persons who were giving themselves to an entire Olympics industrial complex, complete with the use of illicit growth hormones. Louise Branson is absolutely right. The Olympics have a way of laying bare political realities, and her next words are particularly important. Particularly, she writes, in dictatorial societies. And this is where we have to come to the absolute recognition that that is exactly what Russia is. Americans recognize that that was true of the Soviet Union, then under the leadership of former Soviet General Secretary Leonid Brezhnev. But it's also true of Vladimir Putin. Putin is indeed Russia's elected president, but he was elected after he had eliminated all the possible competition, including sending many of his competitors to jail. In its editorial entitled The Putin Games, the Wall Street Journal editors wrote, "In its wisdom, the International Olympic Committee in 2007 awarded the Winter Games to the one subtropical spot in Chile, Russia, which happens to sit right next to terrorist safe havens and active war zones in the Caucasus. What could go wrong?" End quote. But they went on to say that the Olympics, this Olympiad, has become a case study in the Putin political and economic method. As the editors write, Russia estimated the cost of converting a beach resort into a world-class ski and winter sports center at $12 billion. The final tab is at least $50 billion, more than every previous Winter Olympics combined, and even more than the 2008 Beijing Summer Games. The Summer Games, by the way, have until now been vastly more expensive than the Winter Games. The vast increase in the cost of the 2014 Winter Olympics was not due to increased costs for security, nor construction cost overruns that were simply necessary because of changes in the work orders. No, the increase from $12 billion to $50 billion was largely due to official corruption. And this is well documented by people in Russia and beyond. As the editors of the Wall Street Journal wrote, and I quote, "Sochi is also a shrine to authoritarianism." All that is true and must carefully be noted. But at the same time, there are athletic competitions underway. There are visions of greatness in terms of human endeavor. There are moral lessons to be seen in terms of the rewards of hard labor and the inevitability of defeat for the most in order that the few may win. There will be remarkable human achievements documented in terms of the 2014 Winter Games. And Christians should understand that this, too, is a picture of what it means for human beings to take dominion, to exercise that very mandate given to us in creation. But as Christians, we always keep in mind, or at least always must keep in mind, the fact that whatever human beings do, individually or collectively, but even more demonstrably when it's collectively, we demonstrate human sin. And thus, we are not surprised when we see sinfulness in various forms, whether it's on the part of the host country and its leader, or on the part of those participating in the Olympics, or on the part of those who are threatening terrorist actions against it. We aren't surprised that such things happen. And at the same time, we do not restrain ourselves from being fascinated by and attracted to the spectacle of human achievement, of competition, and of all that is demonstrated in the Olympic Games and in the actual athletic competitions. So as Christians, it's quite safe to watch the Olympics, but let's be very careful that we do not see them as more or less than they actually are. Shifting back to the United States, big news came over the weekend, indeed on Saturday, when United States Attorney General Eric Holder made a major announcement as he was speaking to a prominent gay rights group, the Human Rights Campaign. The Attorney General announced that on Monday, that is today, he would sign into effect changes in terms of how the Department of Justice considers married same-sex couples, even those living in jurisdictions, that is, states, where there is no legal same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage in this country at present is found in 17 states plus the District of Columbia, which is to say that a majority of the states, and thus a majority of the legal jurisdictions in this country, do not yet recognize legal same-sex marriage. But in his remarks, prepared remarks before the Human Rights Campaign, the Attorney General declared, quote, "In every courthouse, in every proceeding, and in every place where a member of the Department of Justice stands on behalf of the United States, they will strive to ensure that same-sex marriages receive the same privileges, protections, and rights as opposite-sex marriages." Now, the particular issues that the Attorney General was announcing came down to such facts as the United States government is now going to treat, for the purposes of bankruptcy, same-sex married couples on the same legal basis as same-sex heterosexual couples. Likewise, in federal cases where the Department of Justice is involved, regardless of the state, that is to say in all 50 states and in the District of Columbia, the Department of Justice will consider a married spouse in a same-sex marriage to have the same right against spousal incrimination in terms of criminal testimony as is true for married heterosexual couples. The Attorney General has stated that the fight for gay and lesbian rights is, quote, one of the defining civil rights challenges of our time, end quote. Gay rights groups, including the Human Rights Campaign, immediately responded to the announcement by the Attorney General with applause and appreciation. But they also announced that they intend to push the Justice Department, the Attorney General, and the President of the United States further on this issue, including demands that President Obama sign an executive order which will ban all forms of discrimination in terms of sexual orientation in matters of federal contracting. All this amounts to a rapid expansion of President Obama's intention, as he stated during the 2012 presidential campaign, to seek to legalize and normalize same-sex marriage. In one sense, there's no real surprise here. The president and his administration have clearly decided to make gay rights and same-sex marriage very clear, defining issues in terms of their political legacy. They've made that decision, and they're holding to it. This is evidence of the fact that they intend to extend that program and agenda well into the future. But as Brad Knickerbocker, writing for the Christian Science Monitor, observes, what this really demonstrates, perhaps more than anything else, is the continued evolution, that's the word that President Obama used for himself, of the president's understanding of same-sex marriage. When he was running for a spot in the Illinois State Senate, quite successfully, President Obama personally, in his own hand, checked off the mark saying that he affirmed the legality of same-sex marriage. Then, as Knickerbocker writes, as a United States Senate candidate, just a couple of years later in 2004, President Obama said, quote, what I believe is that marriage is between a man and a woman, end quote. Knickerbocker then reports that just 6 years later, 2 years after he'd been elected president, the president told a group of liberal bloggers, quote, I have been to this point unwilling to sign on to same-sex marriage primarily because of my understandings of the traditional definitions of marriage, end quote. The president had gone on during that session with liberal bloggers to say, quote, but I also think that attitudes evolve, including mine, and I think that is an issue that I wrestle with and think about because I have a whole host of friends who are in gay partnerships, end quote. Knickerbocker then writes, since then, gay marriage has accelerated as a social and political issue in America. And of course, the president has continued to evolve, to use his own word. Early in the year 2012, when he was running for re-election to a second term as president, he announced that his position had evolved to the point that he now endorsed the legalization of same-sex marriage. Remember, that was just barely 2 years ago. As a matter of fact, not quite 2 years ago. Just a matter of months later, the president put his Justice Department on the side of furthering the cause for gay marriage in terms of two very important cases before the United States Supreme Court. Those cases were handed down last June, and now the actions undertaken by the Attorney General indicate that this president and his Justice Department, along with the Attorney General, are intending to press the issue even further. But what makes this truly interesting from a Christian worldview perspective is what we are watching in terms of the political and cultural progress of this moral revolution. President Obama's evolution on the issue of same-sex marriage was made possible because of the larger change in the American understanding of the issue and of a tremendous moral change that has been taking place within the culture at large. The president basically admitted this quite straightforwardly in his recent interview, a massive interview, with The New Yorker magazine. But what the president really is doing here is evolving just slightly ahead of the American people. It's a very coy political move. But it's particularly coy and manipulative when you consider the fact that the president affirmed the legalization of same-sex marriage years ago when he was running for the Illinois State Senate. He then denied it when he was running for the United States Senate. He denied it again when he was running for president the first time, only to change his mind and to evolve to a new position when he was running for re-election in 2012. The president knows he has a credibility crisis on this because basically no one on either side of the equation had any doubt about what he actually believed on same-sex marriage all along. It was well understood by people on both sides of the cultural and moral divide that the president was simply speaking out of electoral necessity and political expediency. And quite honestly, he's hardly the first president to do so. And he's also doing what is basically a very bipartisan pattern on one issue or the other. On this issue, in particular, it has been a Democratic pattern. This takes us back to former President Bill Clinton, who, as President of the United States in 1996, signed into law the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, defining marriage for the United States government as the union of a man and a woman, and only as the union of a man and a woman. Then last year, as a former president, President Clinton declared that he hoped the court would find the very law that he signed into law unconstitutional. And then after the court did just that, he celebrated the fact. Now, in any normal circumstance, this would seem to be something of an embarrassment to a politician, but in this case, we had a former president celebrating the fact that a bill he signed into law was now found to be unconstitutional. This can only be explained by a larger moral change taking place around us that has led this former president, and now the sitting president, to believe that it is expedient to tell the American people that they've changed their mind on the issue. There's actually, of course, very little credibility, if any at all, to the fact that either one of these men changed their moral understanding on the question. Rather, what was changed, and has now changed utterly, is their political calculation in terms of the political plausibility of efforts to legalize same-sex marriage. Finally, USA Today, just over the weekend, had an interesting cover story entitled Singles Embracing Once Taboo Choices. As Sharon Jason reports for USA Today, today's singles are an accepting bunch up to a point. She goes on to say most singles say some relationships once considered taboo are fine, quotation marks around the word fine, including interracial marriage, interfaith marriage, and same-sex marriage. Now, that's a very interesting list, of course, implying that the three are of the same moral importance. But what's really interesting in this article is the fact that these single adults responding to this survey indicated that there are limits to their sexual libertarianism. As Jason writes, these include those things that they think are not fine, sexually open marriages in which partners agree that each may have extramarital sexual relationships. They say not fine to married couples sleeping in different bedrooms or living in different homes and long-distance marriages in general. Helen Fisher of Rutgers University, trying to explain the data, said this, quote, everything that is not fine has one element in common, a disruption of that profound connection between two people. From a Christian worldview perspective, what's really interesting about this report and the research that is behind it is the fact that even these young, single Americans hold to some form of sexual morality. It's an arbitrary form, but you'll notice that they are not complete sexual relativists, and they don't have a permissive attitude towards every kind of sexual relationship or behavior. Now, they've come up with their own system of differentiating between those things that are fine and not fine. It's a pretty flimsy moral structure, to be honest. There's not much moral substance here, and it's also not likely to be a moral structure that holds for any time. But what it does tell us is this. Everybody has a list. Even the people who are against lists, that is, lists of what's good and what's bad, have a list. They may redefine the list from good and bad, from morally righteous and morally unrighteous, to fine and not fine, but here's the bottom line testimony. And Christians should understand that this points to what it means to be moral creatures, made as moral creatures by our divine Creator. Everybody has a list. We might label it differently, but everybody has a list. At 12:30 today, I'll be presenting a public lecture in the Student Union Building of the University of Texas at Austin. I'll be delivering the lecture, which is entitled Moral Man and Immoral Foreign Policy, The Irony of International Relations, for the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Policy there at the University of Texas. Again, that's at 12:15. At 7 o'clock until 9 o'clock this evening, I'll be speaking in the same building in the Student Union at the University of Texas at Austin to an assembly of Christian students and representative Christian organizations. I'll be speaking on the Christian mind in the post-Christian age. Perhaps I'll have a chance to see some of you there. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Austin, Texas, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.